Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, on this, the final session of the Alaska Native Review Commission here in Fairbanks. My name is Tom Berger, and I've been appointed by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People to conduct this review, and we're obtaining the views of Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally in all regions of the state. Regarding the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, its impact, the issues that people are talking about relating to 1991 sale of shares, the possibility of land becoming subject to tax 20 years after conveyance, the question of the right of children born since 1971 to participate in the settlement, Native government, and so on. And we've had meetings already in the West Coast and in the Utna region. We've had meetings in Anchorage, and we had a meeting for the students at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks on Wednesday, and then we had meetings here at the Polaris Hotel on Thursday and Friday, and again today. So far, we've had about 30 students at the university, most of them Native students, make presentations here. And in the meetings Thursday and Friday, we have had approximately 40 people here in Fairbanks, mostly Alaska Natives, some non-Native persons, and some others make presentations, so it's been a very useful time, and we decided we'd reconvene this morning in case there were any others that wanted to take advantage of this hearing this morning to speak who could not do so on Thursday and Friday. Proceedings are being recorded by Jim Sykes, who is with me, and then transcribed, and the tapes and the transcripts are going to be available at the University of Alaska library here in Fairbanks. So if you wish to speak, if you wouldn't mind just coming and being seated here at the mic so your words can be recorded, that would be much appreciated. The first thing I should say this morning is that we have received a brief from the Alaska Métis Association, and it is signed by Bob Pickock, Dorothy John, and Rob Panamariov, and it's an extensive brief, and it will form part of the record of the proceedings, reminds me that I should tell all of you that we are happy to receive submissions in writing, and the submission of the Alaska Métis Association will form part of the official record and will be deposited at the University Library here in Fairbanks, along with all the other materials assembled by the Commission. The only other thing I should say is that at the end of these hearings and meetings, I will write a report which will become available next year and will be based on the record of what is said at these meetings. So that having been said, we can get underway, and Mr. Barry Jackson, I understand you would like to proceed, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I come before you not to speak to many of the concerns that have been expressed to you, although I will comment on some of them, but rather to try and put the present effort and the situation of the Alaska Natives and the Native Claims Settlement Act in historic perspective, and to hopefully establish some background which will assist you in submitting proposals, recommendations, and so on to Alaska's Native people to the Inuit and to others who are interested in resolving problems that exist under the Act. There are many problems under the Act, and you have heard about many of them. But I think it's important to recognize that, in my opinion at least, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 is probably the worst Native settlement ever been entered into as of that date, except for all others that have ever been tried. It has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all others that have been tried. And I think the comparison is similar. First, consider the magnitude of the Act and the settlement under the Act. First of all, transferred legal title, fee title. We call it confirming legal title because we felt as an attorney and as Native people in Alaska that they had Aboriginal title to virtually the entire state. Confirmed under the Act was over 40 million acres of land, an area somewhat the size of the state of Colorado, roughly 1 acre out of every 50 acres in the United States, roughly 1 acre out of every square mile in the world, to something on the order of 70,000 Alaska Natives. At least as of that time, there had never been a settlement of that magnitude, together with approximately $1 billion in cash. My role in that was as a technician. I was approached nearly 19 years ago by the village of Minto to represent them because they had lost their attorney, who was Ted Stevens, now minority leader, Assistant Minority Leader of the United States Senate, and they were threatened with the state acquiring their lands. Subsequently, I came to represent the village of Nenana, Fairbanks Native Association, the village of Tanacross, other villages in the interior, the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and for approximately a year, I was co-general counsel to the Alaska Federation of Natives. In that role as an attorney and as a technician, I was, in effect, the architect of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I came up with ideas such as land selection, stock, regional corporations, village corporations, and many of the other things that are in there, including things that we don't like. 20 years on restraint on alienation of stock. I proposed 100 years. I felt that 50 years at least would be needed in order to establish an ethic of handling ownership of stock, of handling corporate ownership of lands, that we needed 50 years tax exemption as well as a 50-year restraint on alienation. Congress refused to give that to us, and we accepted 20 years. But I think it's also important to recognize that Congress did not impose the Act upon the Alaska Native people. In fact, what happened was that the Alaska Native people, through its leadership, with the assistance of lawyers and with the assistance of allies, with the assistance of lobbyists, put through the most fantastic Native Claims Settlement Act that has been seen in the history of the United States. They, in fact, imposed their will upon Congress, upon the presidency, upon the Interior Department, upon the state of Alaska, upon the United States. True, we had to give up certain things in the process, such as not having 50 years of restraint on alienation. We did not get what we wanted in the way of a statewide Native corporation. We did not get the right to restrict alienation of stock to descendants of Natives, so that although it might be freely transferred for profit, for sale, for money, at least the ownership would remain among the Native people forever. And there were other things we didn't get. But the basic structure, the total amount of money, the total amount of land, these were dictated by Alaska's Native leadership. In that context, turn to the problems that we have, and they are serious. For example, we figured at the very beginning that it should be possible for the corporations to transfer land in partial distribution of assets to corporate shareholders, Native shareholders. that they could all receive, for example, 160 acres perhaps, or 40 acres, or 10 acres, or something, everybody equally. That, I think, still could be done under the existing structure. But no corporation has yet done it, to my knowledge. A couple have dealt with ideas like that. It's my understanding that in the Otna region, at least one village has made available like 5-acre home sites to every shareholder. There's no reason why that can't be done. All it has to be is fair to all shareholders. Restraints on alienation. I suggested shortly after the act was passed that it would not be difficult at that time to have shareholders agree to give up their right to freely alienate their stock after 1991 and put certain restrictions on it. One that we had discussed at an early stage was that for, let's say, another period of time, such as 20 years, the stock could only be sold to other shareholders and descendants of shareholders of that corporation. That for an additional period of time, say another 50 years, only to other shareholders and descendants of shareholders of that region. And that only after, say, 100 years would it become freely alienable, but even then, only to Alaska Natives and their descendants. This, of course, would require giving up a property right. You would be restricting your free right to sell your stock after 1991. But in 1972 or 1973, I think it would have been possible to persuade freely, openly, knowingly, the great bulk of Alaska's Native shareholders to place such restrictions on their stock so that they would know that the corporations would remain in Native ownership and Native control forever. That effort was never carried through. It is more difficult as individual shareholders see the possibility of money to persuade them to place such restrictions on their stock. It is not too late to do so. It would also be possible to do so by legislation, by Congress, but in so doing, some value would have to be placed on the restriction that is being placed on the stock, because it would be taking property without just compensation otherwise. But I think that Congress has the power to do that, provided they provide just compensation for the diminution of the value of the stock. And I would suggest that the diminution of the value of the stock would be very small by such a restriction.
How would Congress compensate? What would be your suggestion?
I would suggest if we could determine what the amount is. If the amount is a fairly small amount, it could be by the corporation that adopted such restrictions and payable only to the shareholders who dissent from placing such restrictions on their shares. The great bulk of the shareholders, I think, would consent to such restrictions. So you'd only have to pay the dissenting shareholders. If it turned out that the amount of money was fairly large and would represent a great burden on the corporations, then I think Congress should provide some funding, not necessarily all of it. Let me turn again to the concept of the historical perspective. When we were designing the Settlement Act, we had the benefit of history and what had gone on in prior settlements. We knew, for example, that during the late 1800s, that Congress had tried to turn Indians generally into farmers, into yeomanry, transferring farms to them, which in turn were taxed by the counties, and the counties then foreclosed on the farms for taxes, and over a period of something like 30 years, about 40 million acres of land passed from Indian ownership into white ownership in the lower 48, roughly the same amount of land that was involved in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. We knew that IRAs had been established. There were not too many in Alaska. We wanted to preserve the right of a village that had an IRA to take title of the land by IRA. We could not get to that through Congress. The other things that we looked at, examples that we looked at, well, there were the Pueblos of New Mexico. And a Pueblo is a combination of a nation, a city, it's a city-state, a religious entity, a church, a total social organization. And with the exception of a small amount of private business in Pueblos, virtually everything, every person fits into a hierarchical structure within the Pueblo. If you're in the Pueblo, you have certain rights, which are very valuable, and a certain place in society and in that structure. But if you, for some reason, are not on the best of terms with the council, you would be well advised to move out of the Pueblo because there's simply no place for you. So one of the things we felt was that it was unwise to try and combine the roles of municipality, of business corporation, of tribal entity, and all of the others into a single entity. We anticipated that we would have, as we have turned out to have, we would continue to have the regional native organizations like the Tanana Chiefs Conference acting as tribal entities, the village tribal entities. We would have, in time, and we got them, school boards, federal credit unions, business corporations under the land claim settlement, and all of the rest. What we did not anticipate, I suppose, was the number of different hats that an individual native leader might have to wear, especially in the village, and the difficulty this might present. We felt that we had strong leadership, and it's still my belief that the Alaska Natives have very strong leadership, but there's a limit to what one man can do. And as it has worked out, I think there are too many responsibilities being placed on too few people. All right, but turning back to the historical context, we looked at the Menominee experiment, where a tribe in Wisconsin had been given land, and their reservation was turned into a county, and they were permitted to engage in business. The problem was that for any one community, to say that you have to do your business in that community is highly restrictive. To say to the members, if you wish to participate, you have to live in this community, is highly restrictive. We felt it was highly desirable to have the ability for Alaska Natives to move freely between the village and the city, freely between Alaska and the lower 48 or the rest of the world, freely wherever their occupation, interest, education may lead them, and still retain the benefits of their membership in the village corporation or the regional corporation. That has come to pass. That is unusual among Native settlements, at least to my knowledge, up until that time. We had experience with the settlement of the Klamath people in Oregon, where large timber holdings were converted into cash, and cash was given to the Indians of the Klamath people. For the great bulk of the Klamath people, the money was gone in 3 to 5 years. And those who were on welfare before were on welfare afterwards. We felt that by concentrating the land, the assets, in corporations, we could preserve it from dissipation, although there might be some losses, and it would be there for centuries to come. You cannot guarantee it. You cannot guarantee anything in this world forever. But at least we would hopefully provide the structure that would maintain the assets and hopefully provide a mechanism for them to grow, a mechanism to provide employment. We utilized the Alaska Business Corporations Act because it comes complete with a law of corporations which establishes the rights of shareholders, the duties of directors, and the general law of corporations. The problem that I found with IRA corporations under the federal law was that there was a very small body of court decisions interpreting the rights of the parties, and the bylaws and articles of incorporation of IRA corporations in Alaska, in my experience, were extremely sketchy. And I felt, and still feel, that the advantage of using corporate form under state law was advantageous. There was another reason for that. The Alaska Native leadership did not wish to be under the thumb anymore of the Department of the Interior and the Secretary of Interior. They had had enough of BIA dictation of how they handled their affairs, and by using the Business Corporation Act under the state of Alaska, it was one way of helping to get out from underneath that. Corporations have been said to be alien to Native people. I suggest that's not only true. Corporations have been called the new tribes. There are many studies out on comparing the way corporations function and the way tribes function. Corporate boards of directors commonly function by consensus, and so do tribal organizations. It seemed to me at the time that the corporate structure was the closest thing under Western law terms to tribes, and that the tribes in Alaska, the villages in Alaska, had held the land essentially in common, not by individual ownership, and by utilizing the corporate form, we would be able to carry on that tradition, that system, and at the same time have all of the other advantages of a full body of law, which establishes the rights, duties, and responsibilities among the members of the corporation. We looked at the possibility of nonprofit corporations. We do have nonprofit corporations in the Tanana Chiefs Conference, for example, in Kowarik, in Nome, which perform either tribal or welfare-type functions. There were two problems that I saw. One was the tendency of the state to say, okay, you got all this money, you are a charitable corporation, you build your own hospitals, you build your own schools, you fund your own welfare and government-type programs. This was a land claim settlement. It was not intended to replace government. It was not intended to be charity. By keeping these as business corporations would reinforce that type of approach to the problem and prevent governments from sloughing off onto these corporations obligations that are really the government. Rockefeller may be a multimillionaire, but Rockefeller has the right to send his kids to public school. He is not limited. There was a strong effort during the land claims fight by a number of people, including at one point, not during the entire period, please, at one point by Governor Hickel, to say, okay, we'll give you all these assets, then you will be able to take care of your own governmental obligations. There was an effort as late as the last year. Governmental obligations.
Obligations, right.
Governmental functions. There was an effort as late as the final year in Congress by a number of people on the House side to put all of the land into the ownership of municipal corporations of the state of Alaska. And we had at that time and still have many villages that are organized as municipal corporations, second class cities under Alaska law, as well as having a business organization, business corporation. So we were fighting that. Another problem with the nonprofit corporation was that some people felt that by going nonprofit, we can avoid federal taxes. Well, it's true that you can have a charitable organization that does not have to pay federal taxes on its profits. And when you make donations to it, you can deduct those from your income tax. But the problem is you cannot set up under American tax law a charity, the principal beneficiary of which is yourself. In short, if the village corporations had been set up as nonprofit corporations under Alaska law, they would have been membership corporations, there would not be any stock that could ever be sold, and they would have been taxed as though they were an ordinary business corporation. So they would have had the worst of both worlds. That's why no village in Alaska, even though they had the option under federal law, organized as a nonprofit corporation. Now, let me talk about one other thing, and that's the stock. Why did we use stock instead of membership? Well, it was my view, and still is, that property, so-called, that you cannot sell, in fact, is not property. And we had an example of that right then while we were writing the Act. By the time the Act was written, we well knew that the state of Alaska had 10 billion barrels of oil on the North Slope, that the net value of the assets of the state of Alaska was in excess of $25 billion, and that if you divided up all of the assets of the state of Alaska by its citizens, we could hand to every man, woman, and child in the state of Alaska $100,000. Okay? But that vast wealth doesn't help an Alaskan citizen get a loan from the bank. And when he gets ready to retire when he's 65 and move to Hawaii, he can't sell his interest in the state of Alaska and take his $100,000 to Hawaii and retire on. In short, unless the stock at some point became alienable to some degree so that a individual owner would have an option, if he wished to do so, of selling his stock for cash and converting his assets into something else, he really didn't have ownership. Now, I do agree that the ownership should be restricted to Alaska Natives. But in the course of time, Alaska Natives and their descendants will exceed 250,000, and in perhaps 100 years, 1 million people. That will provide a considerable market for the stock, so that those who do wish to sell stock will have a ready market for it, and yet the corporations can still remain in ownership of Alaska Natives and their descendants. I'm sure you or the members of the audience may have questions of me. I'd be happy to answer them. I'm not sure that I've addressed all of the concerns that we have at the moment, but I'd be happy to comment further on any part of it.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Jackson, about the fact that no village has chose the non-profit mode. I was told elsewhere that the reason for that was that there could be no distribution of cash or other assets to the members.
That's correct.
I see.
That's correct. You could make charitable distributions, but the charitable distributions does not prevent the corporation from being taxed under federal law. And yet you cannot make equal distributions, such as dividends, or distributions in partial dissolution, partial liquidation, as this term is used. Now, a Native village corporation today can make a distribution in partial liquidation by giving everybody 5 acres, as long as each 5 acres parcel is equal in value to the others. You could not do that as a nonprofit corporation. I want to comment on one other thing that I think is important, and that is the concept of the closed roll. This was considered at the time, and we decided to close the roll. And it's a very complex question, and it could go either way. But consider the long-term implications of an open roll that then you run into what is called the tragedy of the commons. And the tragedy of the commons, and this would take literally 100 years in Alaska Native corporations before you'd see the effect of it. The tragedy of the commons is when anyone can use a resource and the resource has a certain carrying capacity. There is no incentive when you are nearing the carrying capacity for each member who can use that resource to restrict their use of the resource. In fact, it's a little bit to the contrary. It's to their interest to increase their use of the resource and get their share out first. All right. The net effect of this is that, let's say, a regional corporation, Doyon Limited, and we have an open roll. Well, the villages that are prolific in having lots of children are going to end up over the long term with the greatest ownership in Doyon. The family that decides to have only one or two children are not really benefiting themselves and their children. They would be it would be in their self-interest to have more children and thereby get a greater share of the assets of Doyon over time and for their grandchildren to do it. This seemed to me to be an unwise. I'm a structuralist. I believe in setting up the rules in ways that encourage people to do what is in their own interest and in the interest of society as a whole. And it seemed to me that having an open rule was contrary to that, that it was better to not encourage large families. Now, if a family decides to have a large family on their own, they have every right to do so. Time, I didn't see how, and I also felt that it was desirable that parents recognize that their children and their children's children are going to share in the assets of the corporation and in participation under the settlement through the parents' own wise stewardship of the assets that have been given to them, and that it is therefore desirable that they recognize the stock they have is where their children and their grandchildren are going to get their stock from.
There's a kind of a reverse side of the coin to the thesis that you adopted, and I'm sure you considered this, that now, with the closed role, children take by inheritance. A couple with 10 children, their children will each take 10% of the shares that each of their parents had. A couple with one child actually will take twice as many shares as each of his parents had. And so, under one arrangement, there was an inducement to people to have children. The way it's worked out, if people were taking these things into account when they decided on their families, there's an inducement to have fewer children, and then your descendants, limited in number, will have a greater ownership in Doyon Corporation.
Mm-hmm. I recognize that, but at least it's the decision. They probably aren't going to think about it, please. You know, I know the parents aren't going to think about it in the average case. But it's their shares that they've received. And they do have the right to say, yes, I'll pass on these to one child or one to 10 children. Whereas in the other, what happens is, it's not my shares when I have 10 children. I'm rather taking shares from these people over here who only had one.
Go ahead.
I want to go on to a little bit, another little point, and that is that, and this really was never discussed, except with a fairly small number of Alaska Native leaders. But I had an interest in real property law, and I was familiar with the struggle of the English courts under the common law on the problems of restraints on alienation and the rule against perpetuities. And it was my view that although restrictions on alienation for a period of time was highly desirable, and I didn't want any Alaska Native to be able to sell their stock for at least 50 years, and I didn't want any land that was undeveloped to be taxable for at least 50 years, that eventually it should become alienable. And while I was willing to restrict alienation to Alaska Natives and their descendants, I felt that at some point within that group at least, it should become freely alienable. The other result, I think, I don't want to get into esoteric concepts of English common law, but I think you're as well aware as I am of the problems that the courts foresaw with the attempts of noblemen and others to make sure that only the eldest son of the eldest son forever retained ownership of the family estate, and it could never be sold, and the problems that that created for society as a whole. And it was the same sort of concern that I had in deciding in my own mind that we were better off following this sort of approach rather than setting up enclaves of reservations or other geographically limited areas and groups holding or controlling that land where you had to be on the land within the geographic area in order to participate.
One suggestion that's been made at a number of the meetings is well, let me back up a bit, and you're undoubtedly better aware than I am of the growth of the IRA movement, sovereignty movement, whatever you want to call it. At some of the meetings, people have gotten up and have said, why can't the corporations, I think they're really thinking of the village corporations, why can't the village corporations assign their land to the local IRA, thus avoiding the all of the 1991 issues, alienation, taxation, and bringing the children born since 1971 into full participation. That's in a sense restructuring the whole settlement, but it does do something that a number of people have said. They've said separate the land from the money, let the corporations have the money and be corporations, let us keep our land under tribal control. Could you make any observations you want to on that?
Yeah. The first question I would have is, what is the membership of the IRA? Are the shareholders of the village corporation who no longer reside in the village, are they going to be admitted to full membership in the IRA? And how are the benefits of membership in the IRA going to be made available to shareholders who don't live in the village any longer? Second, I have always felt that we should use every legal device available to us, including IRAs. My own view was it was not wise to transfer all of the land to an IRA. But I certainly thought that one concept that could be used would be to transfer land for economic development, for a manufacturing plant. We're not likely to have very many manufacturing plants in the villages, but for an example, if you were going to install a manufacturing plant, a logging operation, say, in a village, you might transfer the land to an IRA corporation in order to get the exemption from tax that flows with the IRA ownership. But it should be fair to the village business corporation and its shareholders. Okay. Now, I do know that the Vinitai, Village Business Corporation of Vinitai and Arctic Village did in fact transfer all of their lands to the IRA corporation. They did take the precaution, as I understand it, of making certain that every shareholder of the Village Business Corporations also signed off on that. So there could be no question that somebody that was put over on somebody without their knowledge and consent. I was not involved in how it was done and when it was done, but it is my understanding that everybody signed off on that. If that is done, I think that is probably legal, although I have not admittedly researched it. I would like to comment on one other thing.
Yep.
And that is that we recognized early on, even before the act was passed, that many of the village business corporations were going to be too small to be economically viable. And we built in some language to provide for a merger. And as you know, in the Kotzebue, there was a merger of all of the village corporations except Kotzebue Village Corporation. And in this region, I think there was a fairly substantial village merger in the Galena area, but we're still faced with the fact that many villages are still too small, and they're going to unfortunately dissipate their cash assets in management. Now, a number of things have been done to try and overcome that, including setting up the Interior Village Association here to provide such management services at less cost. But I think that some amendment to the Act, or even some state legislation to encourage mergers and at the same time establish standards for the merger process would be highly desirable. As you may know, there was a merger attempted in Koniag region, which was set aside, and I don't think it would have been set aside if proper standards had been followed in following through on the merger. The problem we have is that we did get exemption from the Securities and Exchange Commission, federal agency, which governs publicly held corporations, on the grounds that they didn't know anything about in the last native corporations and were not competent to manage it, and I still believe that. But in the process, we didn't have anything to put in its place. And something similar, but not nearly as elaborate, especially with regard to mergers, shareholder suits, and similar matters at the state law level, probably would be appropriate. I'd rather do it at the state law level than having the SEC get involved, because I just don't think the SEC is ever going to figure out what Alaska Native corporations are.
One of the ways in which corporations normally raise money is by issuing shares from the Treasury. As the Act stands now, I assume that shares cannot be issued from the Treasury to anybody, natives or non-natives. Is that so?
Under American law, Treasury shares means shares that had been issued, for example, to shareholders earlier on and for some reason passed to the ownership of the corporation. We may well want to use Treasury shares as a means of avoiding alienation to non-natives. For example, having a rule that before stock can be sold to a non-native, it must be offered to the corporation, and the corporation must have the right to buy it at whatever the offering price is. As to other stock issued by the corporation, generally corporations can always pass a resolution that they will increase the amount of authorized shares or that they will issue shares that have been authorized but not yet issued. Alaska Native corporations have that power. They may even have that power today. I haven't researched it. I have assumed that they would not issue such shares to non-natives, make them available for sale to non-natives. They could issue other types of securities, however, such as bonds that would not carry voting rights. And they could raise money by issuing bonds and still preserve ownership and control in native stock holders.
There was a witness here last night, Larry Peterson, who used to be in the state legislature, I believe, who said that back in the 70s there was in fact a movement for a state property tax on land, a state tax on land led by Charlie Parr of Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. This was his. Any idea, any thoughts on the question whether or not in the future, with oil revenue declining, that's what I read in the papers, conceivably the state of Alaska in the late 80s, early 90s, short of revenue and yet with very significant maintenance costs to all the capital installations established with oil money, have you considered whether there's any real likelihood of a tax on land imposed by the state?
There is a possibility, and we've got to face it. But that also brings up another point, and that is that one of the advantages I saw of the settlement was the vesting of large amounts of land and money in Native corporations, especially the regional corporations, and the continued existence of Alaska Federation of Natives and the regional Native associations would create a political power that for the number of people involved was probably unique under the American flag. Now, that political power in the course of time may decline because the number of non-natives in the state may continue to increase at a greater rate than Alaska Natives. But it's still going to be quite significant. Now, we also today have the conservation environmental ethic, which is very strong. Alaska Native corporations control about as much land as there is in the state of Colorado. The great bulk of it, nearly all of it, is vacant land that should be left in that state. To place taxation on that land is going to force Native corporations to develop it, lease it, sell it, or otherwise raise money. You will note in the Act, if I remember correctly, I wrote this pretty carefully, I think, so long as the state doesn't tax the land, the Native corporations are entitled to receive free firefighting protection from the Bureau of Land Management. Now, it's very carefully written. It doesn't say so long as it's exempt under this act. It says so long as it is not taxed. So the Native corporations are going to be very upset about any attempt to tax the land because it not only puts a burden on them for that reason, but it also means that they're going to have to pay out money to somebody to provide for fire protection on the valuable timberlands they may have. There has been legislation to provide for land bank so that Native corporations can put money, land in their in land banks and thereby ensure that it's not subject to taxation. I am not familiar with the present statute on that subject, but it's my impression that it will carry on past the 20-year tax exemption period.
That provision was included in ANILCA, was it not?
I think so, yes, sir.
You haven't mentioned the fact that subsurface resources under village corporation lands were to be held by the regional corporations. Any comments on that?
Well, the concept that mineral resources should be held by the regional corporation, I think, makes sense. Congress, it was their staff that wrote up the language there. While the basic concept we had no problem with, the way they wrote it up has turned into a morass of litigation, which is only now being resolved. It does raise the other subject, which I think is important, and that is the concept of sharing between regions and between villages. The concept here was we didn't agree with the 30-70 ratio that came out in the Act. We did at one time suggest like a 50-50 ratio, and we felt it was important that all Alaska Natives share if one region or one village reaped a bonanza. We knew about the North Slope. We could anticipate that perhaps 100 years from now there may be a similar development.
One region reaped a bonanza.
One region or one village, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You have villages in southeast Alaska that are, from the standpoint of the value of their timber, assuming that the timber industry revives, will have extremely valuable timber and resources on the order of $250,000 per shareholder in the village. And I think there was one village, I'm not certain of these facts, so I better say simply it's my understanding that one village has paid out in excess of $10,000 per shareholder in 1 year in dividends. So in the Act, we provided, initially, we were going to provide that both the subsurface resources, the minerals, and the timber would be shared. The way the Act came out of Congress, there was no sharing on most of the timber.
So So that Southeast doesn't share its resources, but the...
Right.
The North Slope shares its.
Yes. Yes. That particular change was due to some last-minute lobbying on behalf of Southeast by its attorney.
Have you, now that this settlement has been in operation for 12 years and 4 months, it's, at the very least, it must be said that it has been the means of preserving and consolidating ancestral native lands. It has given political influence to native people, a point you mentioned. What about, have you any observations to make on the performance of the corporations as corporations, particularly the regional corporations? The village corporations are you mentioned their
right.
performance. What about the regional?
I think the most serious mistake made by regional corporations, and this is a very common mistake, is for them to attempt to manage an operating business. I really feel they do not have available to them the talent in sufficient depth among all of the corporations to run major operating businesses. And when they get into trying to operate a business, very often they lose money, and they lose money very fast. If they took a more passive approach to their investments, investing in minority stock ownership, less than controlling interest, in banks, airlines, other industries in Alaska, other enterprises, not just in Alaska, but who may have Alaskan contact, ITT, RCA, and so on, they could probably have done better and provided for employment opportunities without having the burden of management control. Wien Airlines, at one time at least, had 25% of their employees were Alaska Natives, including three jet captains and a vice president of operations. So there were opportunities in business corporations in Alaska for Alaska Natives to work. But if a regional corporation had tried to take over Wien and manage Wien, I think it probably would have had serious losses. If they had purchased a 20% shareholding interest, I think that 20% shareholding interest with representation on the board of directors would have provided them with all of the benefits and without the risk of having management responsibility. The regional corporations, when it comes to handling in-house management of staff, when it comes to making investment decisions, when it comes to listening to investment advisors and attorneys and so on, I think the boards of directors have done a good job in that area. It's when they get into active management responsibility that they often come a cropper.
One of the complaints we hear about the corporations in the villages where we've been holding meetings is that there haven't been any dividends to speak of. But more important than that seems to be the complaint that they haven't provided any employment locally. There was a perception on the part of Alaska Natives living in the villages that the corporations, village and regional, would in some way be offering employment to Alaska Natives. And the problem with employment opportunities in the villages, and this is so in Greenland and Canada as well as here, is that there just aren't very many, no matter how much money is being pumped in. You have your basic subsistence economy, you have government services, somebody has a cafe, and that may be just about it. But and if corporations do try to undertake the stimulation of the local economy, sometimes they run into real difficulties. Was any of this foreseen, or whether it was or not, do you have any observations to make on that?
We may not have done a good job of explaining it to all of the villages at the time we developed the concept of the settlement, but it was well understood at that time that you can't, pardon me, piss your money away. That if you're going to have employment in the villages, it has to be an economically viable enterprise. Now, we talk about these corporations as being for profit. Even a non-profit corporation cannot run at a loss. If it does, it goes into bankruptcy. Now, Coeric, which is the nonprofit in Nome, had to go into bankruptcy, into Chapter 11 at one time, because the state refused to pay cost overruns that the state properly should have paid, but they didn't. Eventually, the state recognized its obligations and paid those cost overruns, and we were able to keep that corporation going and get it turned around, and it's making money. Even though it's a nonprofit, it has to make money in order to keep going. The federal government also refused to pay certain cost overruns that they ought to have paid. The federal government has never paid those. As a result, certain creditors of Coeric received 40 cents on the dollar, and that's all they got, because the feds wouldn't recognize their obligation. Which simply gets back to, if you want employment in the villages, it's got to be economically viable. Otherwise, you are dissipating the assets of the corporation without doing anything for the people over the long run. And this relative lack of economic opportunity for viable enterprises in the villages was one of the reasons we felt it was important that village corporations, as well as regional corporations, be able to enter into business anywhere. And at one time, Tim Wallace was approached by somebody in the Anchorage region and said
he was
then Tananaw Chiefs, okay, by somebody in the Cook Inlet region and said, after the settlement, we're going to build a nice hotel here in Anchorage, and we want you to stay out. And Tim Wallace says, if I can make more money by building a hotel on top of you, I'm going to do it. The fact of the matter is that competition is a fact of life. We may not like the fact that there is competition, but it cannot be ignored. These corporations have to make their own way in the world. And if that means that they are going to be building an office building in Fairbanks and thereby have some positions available that they can make available to village people that want to come into town and want to work, fine. But it does no good to build that office building out in the bush if nobody's going to rent it.
One other thing is that the capital that was made available to the corporations was staggered over a period of 10 years, as I understand it. Could you tell me whether that was intended from the beginning, and whether or not it was, what the impact of that infusion of capital being renewed each year has had in terms of management attitudes in the corporations?
At the beginning, I don't think there was any planning behind spreading the money out over a period of time. There was some, admittedly. If you'll take a look at the curve, you'll see that there's a certain curve to it that makes some sense. But it was really developed as a way of reducing the impact on the federal treasury. They didn't want to lay it all out at once.
See.
Now, in terms of the net effect, it's impossible to say whether it would have been better if they'd been handed all the money at once in the first year. my guess is it probably is better the way it worked out. But you can't tell. There's no way of being certain.
No.
I'd like to turn to one other thing.
Yeah, please do.
This settlement was a result of the efforts of a lot of people. The Native leadership gave unselfishly of their time and money. Lobbyists as well. There were 40 attorneys involved. And I became involved just about 19 years ago. The system at that time required that you get a contract approved by the Secretary of Interior. The Secretary of Interior, as a condition to approval, said, in effect, this is the terms of the contract that I will approve, and none, no other. In fact, they dictated the terms of the contract. The contract provided for an equitable fee, but not to exceed, in all events, 10% of what was recovered by the client. I entered into such contracts with the villages of Minto, Tanner Cross, and Nenana, which were approved by the Secretary, and we got other contracts on the same form that the Secretary never approved. Congress, when it passed the act, abrogated that contract and said that I could not collect under it, and set aside a fund of $1,900,000 to pay all 40 attorneys. I received $130,000, which was less than what my wife had loaned me to go do the work. I felt that this was wrong, and I felt that it would be a handicap to Natives in the future in going to Congress, or in Alaska, not just Alaska Natives, but American Indians, in going to Congress seeking land. Because the way the system works, if you're seeking money, you can go to the courts, the Court of Claims or the Indian Claims Commission. But if you want land, you have to go to Congress. Well, with a precedent that Congress had established that if you go to Congress for land, Congress can tell your attorneys that the contracts they entered into are no good and they are not going to get paid anything near what the value of what they did. It's going to make it difficult for Native Americans to get attorneys to take cases to Congress. And I believe that that is a serious impact on their right to counsel. And I think it exists today. The Indian law bar is concentrated in Washington, D.C. There are very few attorneys who practice outside of Washington, D.C. I don't anymore. And it's well known among the Indian bar that if you go to Congress, you may, in effect, get ripped off. Now, I don't think that discussion ever comes up between an attorney and...